This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. More people these days are growing their own fruits and vegetables to provide their families with a steady supply of fresh foods, but some backyard gardeners are finding they've grown too much. And many of them are discovering the value of small market gardening as a way to make extra money or even start a new career. Joining us to discuss small market gardening and to answer your horticulture questions are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Crop Production Manager at Turner Farm Megan Gambrill, and from the Campbell County Extension Office, Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles and Agriculture Agent Don Sorrell. And you can join us with your gardening questions at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Don, Kate, Megan, and Sarah, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Kate, define this for us. What exactly is a market garden? What are we talking about here?
So the main difference between being a home gardener or hobby gardener and a market farmer or gardener is that the market gardener, it's a business. You have to keep track of what you're planting, how much money you might make off of it. You need to have insurance. You know, there's going to be more outgo than just, you know, growing stuff in your backyard, because if you want to participate in a market, that costs. You know, if you want to sell to restaurants, you have to have insurance, liability insurance, to cover that risk. And so it gains a level of complexity that most small businesses have to deal with anyway.
Mm-hmm. So, is microfarm another term for this?
It can be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what is the potential benefit of this, other than obviously you can make money from doing this, but I mean, what?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes you can make money from doing it, but what are some of the other benefits of this type of gardening?
Well, the benefits, personally, I've gotten to really serve my community more than just purely growing out of my backyard. When I started doing this as a profession, both Megan and I participated in the Findlay Market Chef Program, which stood for Creating a Healthy Environment for Farmers. And that was a USDA grant program where I went from just growing out of my backyard to participating in smaller urban lots and going and selling at Findlay Market twice a week. And that really kind of threw you into the business aspect of it, because all of a sudden you needed to really keep track of not only what you were producing for yourself, but also what the market demands were. And it's all right if we like eating certain things, but if that doesn't sell at market, then you really have to change up what you do if you want to be able to make money. And that's after paying yourself.
And it's important to know, too, you know, a lot of us think maybe farmers or agriculture is in rural parts of your communities. And this market garden brings economic development into community. So mm-hmm. It gives an opportunity, and I also think awareness and appreciation as well. So, you know, you don't need acreage of land. So a small parcel piece of land in urban parts of your communities, and you can actually grow quite a bit of produce for yourself and or have that as a market garden and sell at market, or grow and sell directly to a wholesaler or a restaurant. So you don't need much land.
Sarah, is this more viable than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago? Because nowadays you've got a lot of farmers markets and restaurants that use local suppliers, plus there's a great interest in local food. So is this more viable these days?
I think it's just awareness. So, you know, agriculture has been around for centuries, right? And so I just think it's awareness and the benefits of growing local, keeping it local, the boost that it helps our economy. And chefs and people are wanting this. Consumers are wanting this and demanding it. So I don't think it's definitely new. It's just, it's just the continuation of local food and the local movement and the freshness and awareness of what we're eating.
I think viability is a really important aspect of it, though, because even at when you go to the farmers market, I mean, a lot of farmers themselves don't even know how much it costs them to produce mm-hmm. a vegetable. And if you don't know how much it costs you to produce it, then you don't know how much to sell it for. And so you're basing your numbers off of what other farmers in the market are selling things for. And they're probably doing the same thing. And you're not necessarily actually covering your costs. And one, like, really simple example would be, like, say it costs me say I actually know that it costs me $2 to grow a red tomato, and I take it to the market, and it costs, and I'm going to sell it for $3. Well, at Philly Market, it costs $50 for to go sell on a Saturday. It's going to be about 9 hours of labor. So say I'm only, you know, paying myself $10 an hour, which most professionals
would not do.
So that's $140 right there. So if it's costing me $2 to grow that tomato and I'm charging $3 for it, in order to just cover the rent and myself, I have to sell 140 pounds of tomatoes.
And that's if you can carry that much tomatoes to market every week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a level of complexity when you start talking about market versus, say, putting up your extra harvest or maybe offering it to your neighbors or things like that. I mean, I have a friend who lives on the west side who's got, you know, a pretty big yard. They might be sitting on a half an acre. And whenever they have overage, they set up a table in their front yard with all their extra produce. And their neighbors just come by and grab it because there is that complexity about actually taking it to market. Yeah. It's not just about I have good stuff, but can I make it look pretty? Can I make it look attractive? Is somebody going to buy my stuff versus what they could go down the street and buy at Kroger?
Yeah.
And that's what you're up against when you start doing it for market.
Well, Megan, you used the word viability. What about sustainability? Are there environmental advantages to doing this type of gardening?
Absolutely. And actually part of, you know, lowering that cost of growing the tomato is improving your soil. Unfortunately, we don't get paid for being stewards of the land. That would be really excellent to be able to have a little, like, land stewardship tax.
Yeah. That'd be lovely.
But instead, you know, you're being pushed to produce more and more, which actually is not to the benefit of your environment. So that's one of the reasons why it's so important to talk to your farmer if you're buying produce. To be aware of in your day-to-day activities if you're growing it.
And think about transportation cost as well. So, you know, a lot of our farmers ask them if they don't advertise that, where are you growing and what, how far do you have to travel to come to this particular market? Or ask the restaurant, chef, or owner, where are you buying your produce? So that will decrease the amount of cost to cover the expense of a particular product.
Well, all these details that you're talking about, I mean, where do you even go to start finding what these things cost? How do you calculate all this?
Well, Don, do you want to chime in and talk about the Homestead Program and Beginning Farmer Program?
Right. One of the things, you know, when you ask about getting started, obviously, from the university standpoint, we do have budgets on a lot of these enterprises, which you can go in and you can punch your own numbers in, and that'll calculate what it's costing you to produce that tomato, you know, from a labor standpoint, fertility, and any type of preventive insecticides or pesticides you may or may not use, organic supplies. But, yes, we are offering – one of the things we're seeing here in Campbell County is that people are coming to us and saying, I just bought 10 acres, okay? And I want to really begin to cultivate that and be a little more self-sufficient as a family unit often. So they become the backyard gardeners sometimes for the first time. So we're offering a program called homesteading just for those type of people. And then if they are very productive and they begin to, you know, utilize and the resources and begin to have more than they want for their family, then they become in the home gardener that has the ability to go to markets or provide revenue for the family other than just self-sufficiency. So we're offering a series of programs this fall starting October the 4th in this area.
And that's through the Campbell County Extension Office?
Yes, uh-huh.
513-419-7100. If you have any questions about market gardening or if you just have any questions about gardening in general, 513-419-7100 to join us. Don, what about regulatory issues? The word legal issues and law have popped up several times in the discussion. What do people need to be aware of in that respect?
Well, obviously, you know, if they're going to go out and actually sell produce to the general public, then obviously it's helpful if they become a part of an organization. They don't always have to, but usually with that becomes insurance and liability through these organizations. There's information on on best management practices and how to prepare and process your fresh vegetables for the market. So that is helpful, I think, to understand. Obviously, there's, you know, you can go to your local departments of agriculture and they can supply you with information. The Extension Service can supply you with some guidelines on how best to begin to market and enter into different marketing opportunities.
I would also like to add that, especially in the state of Ohio, our state organic certifying agency, OFA, the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association, they offer a number of classes and workshops and tours, and then they have a big conference in February that's just full of information for people of, you know, all stages of that learning process. I mean, from the beginner home gardener to experienced market farmers. I've been presenting workshops there for the last 5 years, and you know, it keeps getting better every year. People come with better questions. I mean, there's also training available for people wanting to get GAP certified. And if you're serious about making it a business to seek out those certifying agencies and the education that they provide, I think is one of the best resources that you can look into.
And I guess it's also a good idea to check your local ordinances, mm-hmm. find out what business licenses you need.
Exactly.
You know, that kind of
exactly.
thing before you yeah. just delve off into this.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea how much this is catching on? How many market gardens there might be in this area? How many small growers, say 5 acres or less, might be in the Cincinnati area?
Perspective. My market garden at Carriage House Farm, yeah. and Carriage House Farm is a 300-plus acre farm in its entirety. My market garden is a 4-acre plot, of which I have about 2/3 of an acre in intensive production, and I pull thousands of pounds of produce out of that over the course of a growing season. So it's not necessarily about having big space. It's about how you manage that space.
Yeah, and a demonstration of farming techniques and practices. Saturday, July 26th, Campbell County is hosting the Backyard Farm Tour. And on that, there will be a demonstration of urban agriculture market garden. It's actually housed at the Campbell County Detention Center. And they're all in raised beds, but from that, they sell to 13 markets there in Newport. And I think it's a great opportunity to demonstrate and provide information to someone who doesn't have or has less than an acre, because that's all that this is. So last year was first year of production, and it sold over $5,600 worth of produce. So you know, again, this could supplement some family income and definitely beginning of the future, and then, of course, expanding that operation. And that's what we are at the start of that production is expanding into greenhouse to fruit trees, things like that. So,
to your question about how many small farmers are out there right now, mm-hmm. I think that number fluctuates a lot because
constantly.
People
yeah.
will go into it.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah, sometimes not knowing what they're getting themselves into. And a lot of times I think that it's not because they don't have the capability, it's that they don't have the right preparation. And then also as part of that preparation, like getting experience in the field, you might learn that actually I love produce, I love growing produce, but I actually don't love growing produce for other people.
It's a lot of work.
And it's really important to get hands-on experience working with other farmers who are doing different types of agriculture, because, you know, there are as many ways to grow food as there are farmers, and every farm is completely different. And there are so many different outlets to sell to. You know, if maybe some people don't like to have the face-to-face interaction at a farmer's market, they prefer to just sell to restaurants or just do wholesale, because then they don't have to stand and talk to people for many hours at a time. And that's just like one small aspect of your business, but that's where your money comes in. So, so I think if there are really a lot of great educational opportunities for people out there, and it would be, and anybody that's interested in pursuing this as a side job, as a career, should really pursue getting hands-on experience, as well as the types of classroom experiences that it sounds like the Extension Agency is providing, in order to figure out, is this really something that I want to do? And can I work by myself
for long periods of time? Truly, because you have to reach a certain level of production to be able to afford help. And that's just the truth.
And it sounds like there are a lot of business management techniques that you have to take into consideration. It's not just about having a green thumb.
Right. Yeah. Right. One of the great joys about it, I think, is like I get to use my entire brain. It's everything. Yeah. It's, the growing. There's the art and the science of the growing. There's the...
You have to be an engineer. You have to be a mechanic, a business person.
Yeah.
You have to be a designer. You have to be able to build business relationships with not only your customers at market, but you get relationships with chefs or, with other larger businesses or retailers. And it can be a wonderful, creative, collaborative thing. Or it can sometimes be a bit of a dictatorship, depending on what kind of thing you're doing and what kind of market you're trying to get into. You'll hear this term, the race to the bottom, sometimes in certain markets, or if you're trying to do wholesale because there's this demand that food must be cheap. And it doesn't matter how high quality my food is and if it's, if it's certified organic or zero spray or if it's conventional or whatever. But there's this idea that the food has to be cheap.
And which is so wrong.
But that's when you find, somebody's like, well, I've got all this stuff. I'm just going to sell it for $5. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, can you do that every week and still pay your bills? You can't. And there's value in what you do. And your time is money. And your product is money. And your product is perishable.
And if you're selling all that stuff for $5, mm-hmm. then the farmer next to you is not going to be able to pay themselves.
Exactly.
Because your customer is now expecting to be able to pay $5 for
Yep.
We will continue our conversation. Take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon to discuss small market gardening and to answer your horticulture questions are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Crop Production Manager at Turner Farm, Megan Gambrill, and from the Campbell County Extension Office, Horticulture Agent Sarah Stulls and Agriculture Agent Don Sorrell. And you can be part of the conversation if you have any gardening questions in general. You can give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jeannie Downtown joins us now. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to ask the question about if you have your own personal garden. I know somebody who's been growing for years, a lot of fruits and vegetables, and they want to get into how do you have like a co-op or something where your neighbors buy into and then they get so much produce? How does that work?
Oh, like a CSA or a community-supported agriculture.
Yes, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jeannie.
So there's a lot of different flavors of CSA. I manage one at the farm that's a workshare CSA where I work with volunteers and they come out and work with me for 2 to 4 hours a week in exchange of a share of whatever's being harvested that week. And then there's other types of CSAs where you pay the farmer up front at the beginning of the season, usually a pretty decent chunk of money, anywhere from $200 to $700 depending on what kind of share it is. And you get a box every week. That's basically the same thing. This is what's in season right now, and this is your share. When it comes to communities trying to pool things for that, I've heard of a couple examples where it's, significantly less upfront cost because the idea is that you're also contributing to that box every week as part of the group. But it really depends on the community and how many people are growing and what those people who are growing need to make off of it. And
if it's just for, just to exchange one good for another good, I would definitely highly suggest you doing like a memorandum of understanding, and making sure there's some rules and regulations, spelled out for everyone so that they see that, one thing of honey equals, X amount of tomatoes, those things. And that is becoming more popular, but I don't see that much happening now here in the Northern Kentucky area.
I think knowing what the value of the produce that she's growing is going to be would is a really hard part, because if you're trying to do it with your community, then you want your neighbors, who are also your friends, to also agree that
this, it's a good value.
That it's a mm-hmm. good value. Mm-hmm. I was going to say another model of CSA that I've seen more recently that I think is a really great idea for beginning farmers is, instead of doing a specific, like, I'm going to have a zucchini and a tomato and a broccoli in one box, I'm going to charge you, you know, you're going to end up getting, say, $500 worth of produce over the course of the season, but you're going to pay me $400 up front, and then you basically shop out of my garden. And that means that there aren't really expectations in terms of number of items or things like that. So it's a little less pressure on the grower to make sure that they have, you know,
enough.
yeah. You know, you just know that you have to get this much value. And then that also allows them to purchase things from other farmers if they're not able to grow as
yeah,
much
to
as
supplement.
To supplement.
Mm-hmm. Fill in the blanks.
Yeah. Is this like going into any business relationship with friends, though? Is there that chance that you could ruin that friendship
always.
In the whole process?
Always.
Always. Yeah. And that's where, you know, for anybody who's looking to use the products that they produce, if you're trying to make money off of it, you have to be solid in what that value is. What, you know, Megan was talking about, how much does it cost to produce, and how do you figure out what that cost is to produce? Okay, well, how much do your seed cost? If you're paying rent on your land, are you leasing it? Do you own it? What's the cost of your land? How much time does it spend in the ground? How much time does it take to harvest it and then get it ready for whoever gets to have it next? These are all factors that go into that pricing.
Are you paying for water?
Are you paying for water?
Electricity?
Yeah. I mean, are you fertilizing? Are you using pesticides or herbicides? All of these things factor into that
cost. There's all that pesky business stuff again.
Uh-huh.
And I think whatever your market model may be or your business model may be, starting and, you know, talk to other farmers, going to these educational classes through Extension or other state agencies, I think this is a beginning of that, and then could even broaden your mind of maybe, what I originally thought may not work out for me in my, you know, my community. Maybe we should think about this. So, the CSA, community supported agriculture models are great, but maybe it may not work exactly in your community. So just talk about it and research it before you are gung-ho about it.
I know that in other cities there are good examples of food bartering systems that have gone successfully. And I can't think of any off the top of my head, but if you look it up, I mean, it doesn't always have to be a monetary exchange. It's just, you know, you got to look for
those.
Yeah. You got to look for the best practices with those and really do your due diligence.
The other thing I would add, especially with overages, is maybe you being a market farmer isn't what you want to do, but maybe you make a mean pesto or a tomato sauce or something. We're starting to see these incubator kitchens pop up in our region. You know, we've got a couple in Northern Kentucky. We've got the one down at Findlay Market now, where if you have a product in mind, that's a whole other possibility for your excess and your overage. And maybe that works out better for you as a small, like, cottage producer. So there are many options of what to do with your overages, not just taking it to market.
Of course, once you get into cottage production, then you're dealing with a whole other
world of legality.
Yes. Hey, Don.
One of the things.
Go ahead.
One of the things that y'all danced around as far as the business side of it, I think one of the things that individuals don't do up front is, they're eager to get in the production side of this, and they really need to have a tremendous feel for the business side of production before they actually plant that first seed or put that first seed in the ground. So, you know, we offer programs that will actually look at this as a business. So you're evaluating your land resources, your time, your management, and building a, you know, business plan, a marketing plan. So those things, I think, need to be stressed as we look at developing unique opportunities for people, whether it's an individual homeowner or a group of individuals going in together for a market opportunity. So we'll be offering this fall a Farm Start program, and we'll be looking at it as a business and trying to hone in on fine-tuning that side of the equation before people really get into some of these. So we'll look at different enterprises and the profitability and the opportunities that are out there for these things.
Well, I'm glad too, Don, you mentioned the word business, the words business plan,
because that's important.
Because that is important, and that I would imagine is one of the key reasons, like any business fails. One of the key reasons that market gardens might fail is they don't have that plan going in the door.
Exactly, and they, you know, if they'll take in most people, and I say most, not everybody, but the average person that likes to, you know, get their hands dirty and sweat in the fields, you know, they're at least likely to sit down and do an in-depth business plan or at least a general overview of what the cost and the opportunities are. So a lot of these things, if you establish this information before you get into this, then you know a little bit more about the expectations of what you might seek in that market opportunity. So I think, you know, understanding the business side of this is just as important as understanding the production side of these enterprises.
And one, yeah, I just thought about this is, you know, you may purchase or currently have 10 acres, for example. I highly suggest not putting all 10 acres in production at once. Oh. So starting small, learning, and then growing your operation. So, you know, farmers are always evolving. They're always growing their operation, but they didn't, you know, they started small. So that's one piece of advice. You know, we get calls quite often, oh, I have an acre and I want to plant something and all the whole acre. Well, let's just, have you ever gardened before? No. Do you like to get your hands dirty? No. Well, let's evaluate that before you plant the whole thing.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, Sarah, because I was reading about somebody who was creating a market garden, and they started with 300 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
That was all they needed. Then the next year, they went to 3,000 square feet. And then a few years later, they were up to 6,000 square feet. So they did it in stages. So I'm wondering if that's kind of a wise approach to just do it gradually, step by step.
Oh, absolutely.
And take notes.
Keep
good records.
And then you just grow from there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And
see what the market, you know. Yeah. I think one of the things you've got to look at, I think if you look at your hand, and if you hold your hand out and fingers out, then you look at that, and I've always been told that the most important thing, you know, is the end result. If you're in it for, you know, a resource and money, is marketing. So you make sure you actually work backwards on this, and you do start small in order to learn and develop what the market entails and what you know, you can grow best in your soil conditions and market correctly and what the consumer wants. So, start small.
And there's also, I mean, you can't just, I mean, if you just look at it for the profitability, then what you're doing is you are discounting the important side of you know, caring for the land and land stewardship. So, you know, you're always working on finding a balance between what you can grow so that you can make the income that you need to make, as well as what you need to do in order to maintain your land. I mean, that's why farms are farmed out, because if you're only focusing on the profitability, then you're gonna ruin your land, and then there's gonna be nothing left. And you know, when we first,
so that connection to the soil is a very important aspect of this.
You know, when we first started,
we actually, in you know, one of the things we encourage people in these programs that we start people, the first thing we look at is evaluating your resources and understanding your resources. We start out with the soil. And we talk about, you know, what type of soil you have. You know, we have the soil tested, you know, for fertility, organic matter, et cetera. And so we really stress the lifeblood of any production with plant production is your soil. And the care for that is extremely important for long-term production and profitability. So I agree with, you know, folks.
513-419-7100 to join us. And Tuckers from Lebanon joins us now. Good afternoon.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, thank you.
So I don't want to steer too off topic. I know you guys are kind of focusing on vegetable production. I had a quick question on transporting bamboo.
Why?
I came into this really late.
That's okay. We said
sorry.
You could.
No.
General gardening questions
are
fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a good one, too.
Yeah.
So transplanting it, or just the idea of planting it, period?
Oh, I guess both. I live down in Cincinnati, and I just found this, I guess, forest full of bamboo. And I was talking to the owner. He's like, "Yeah, take as much as you want."
Of course, they said that.
Yeah, yeah. So
I really spread like wildfire. But I live down in Cincinnati. And I'm kind of trying to block up the front of my house from this main road.
Well,
I figured, what better to do that with than bamboo?
Well, you might surround your house self.
It might take over your house.
Yeah, yeah. So
it, might
it is.
Your house.
That'd be kind of cool too.
Yeah, it is invasive. So I would say make sure you really like it first before you actually plant it into the ground. My dad had this trick where he would take like garbage cans and he would plant the bamboo into the garbage can and then sink the garbage can into the ground, and that will contain it.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. So that will contain it.
Now
you still need to be careful.
I've heard of roots like busting through walls.
Mm-hmm. It can. So you need to keep an eye on it. And also, you also need to make sure you have some holes in the bottom or along the side so that water can escape. But you need to keep an eye on it because the plant will also try to escape through those holes.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a metal or a plastic trash can?
He did both. And I think that the plastic ones were the better option for a short-term planting because you have to get them back out of the ground before the plastic degrades to the point where the bamboo is just going to take over the world anyway.
And you need to harvest it. You do need to harvest it. We actually had about 12 to 15-year-old establishment at our education garden, and it was not harvested. So that will, you know, decrease, I guess, the invasiveness of that. But it's still invasive. And you can use it for trellising, for art, there's all kinds of stuff that you can use bamboo with. But I just encourage you to know that it is invasive, and just because it's there, you should harvest it periodically.
Don, any other thoughts for Tucker on bamboo?
Actually, I guess hopefully he understands that it is invasive, and I think if you've got to have a plan out front. If you just plant a couple plants in your front yard and don't manage it, don't retain that in some form or fashion, then it will begin to creep out very quickly and establish itself, you know, to the point where you've got a forest in front of your house.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up lowering the value of your home.
Yeah, and it can also destroy concrete, too. I mean, I've seen it bust up sidewalks and stuff.
It destroys biodiversity. So one many reasons why we got rid of it is we wanted to increase our monarch way station at our education garden, and it was creeping into that and taking over. So we got rid of it. And, when we got rid of that, our native plants were coming up and, you know, we saw other things blooming because, again, an invasive species, it will outcompete the desirable or native plants. So just remember, it destroys the environment.
It looks cool.
Your ecosystem, I should say.
It looks cool, but it can be a problem. We will continue our gardening conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and my guests this afternoon are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Crop Production Manager at Turner Farm Megan Gambrill, and from the Campbell County Extension Office, Horticulture Agent Sarah Stolls and Agriculture Agent Don Sorrell. You can join us with questions about market gardening or just gardening in general, 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we got an email from Nan, and she says she planted naked ladies by the mailbox. Heavy sun, leaves have turned yellow and look dead, and no stalks have come up yet. So she's wondering, are these indeed dead? Any hope for these?
Well, first thing I think about is drainage. So, if they were healthy plants that she received, if it stays too wet, if it's not good soil, clay, for example, that yellow tends to be a chlorotic symptom. And so that's just a deficiency in nitrogen. So, I would start to see what her soil type is, what her drainage situation may be, because they don't like a lot of what we call wet feet.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts, Ward?
I wouldn't add fertilizer until you really identify what's going on. Do not add any type, even if it be organic, unless it's compost, to them in the soil.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Hannah in College Hill. Hi, Hannah.
Hello. I'm sorry for the noise. I'm actually at the grocery store. So anyway, my question goes a little off in that I wanted to ask about people who are selling meat and eggs at a farmer's market. You know, you can look at stuff and it'll say local, which means a 400-mile radius. You can look at stuff that says antibiotic-free and assume that that means that, you know, the poultry, the meats have not been fed antibiotics, food. But the thing that I have a question about is, you know, when in conventional farms, not only will animals get antibiotic, you know, additions to their feed, they'll also get ground up parts. I know this is gross. Ground up parts of, like, other animals, like, you know, brains and kidneys and stuff like that go into meat feeds and, you know, other animal parts ground up go into chicken feed, and that affects not only the meat but the egg.
Okay, Hannah, so your question is?
Well, the question is a comment on the last one. How do you know that you're truly dealing with something that hasn't been adulterated and that the food is doesn't contain those body parts? Mm.
If you're dealing with farmers or a someone that's actually producing a product and you're actually going to buy something from them, you just need to ask questions about their production system, maybe even pay them a visit if you're really trying to build a relationship with someone. And that's one of the keys is, can you trust this farmer or this person to be telling you the truth? If they say they're organic, then you need to ask them questions and explain this to them. So, you know, if they say, we're selling locally grown, antibiotic-free, hormone-free, ask them to give you information about what that means. And if they can't give you a clear and definitive answer, then they're probably not well in tune about what that truly means. And another thing to answer your question there, you had mentioned about animal feeds having animal-derived products in those. Those are against the USDA, are not allowed, period. So you cannot go to even a local farm store and buy a feed that has animal byproducts in that fed to other animals. So that is no longer allowed. So you're not going to see that.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's all
regular.
Learn something new every day. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to say
it'll have plant products in there. It'll have plenty of, you know, most of the, a lot of the energy and protein in those products are all plant derived. Soybeans, corn, you name it, it's going to be in there.
Megan.
Read the label.
Yeah. In terms of the term local is defined by whoever is using the word. So, I mean, I think Kroger defines it as 400 miles. If you go to a farmer's market that has a specific radius, they may say, well, local for us is 500 miles or local for us
50 miles.
I meant 50 miles. Yeah. Or, yeah, 100 miles. You know, so it's local is, you know.
Ish.
Yeah.
So if you're really concerned about that, you have to ask.
Yeah, you have to ask. And then talking to your farmer is the most important thing. And if you are worried about those things, really the best thing to do is just to buy food from a farmer. Because if you think that the food at the farmer's markets are on the expensive side, the thing is that you can, you know, purchase like a side of beef or a half of a pig, and that'll cover you for a long time. And the difference in cost will be less when you're buying in bulk.
And this is also important, you know, going on these backyard farm tours to see the operation, to see where the farm you know, how it operates. You know, talk to the farmer, not only at the farmer's market, but actually seeing their operation. So not just in Campbell County, but this is, you know, fall festivals come up, you know, almost every year. And, you know, go to the farms and see their operation.
But I would also add that respect the farms as a business in that
Absolutely.
Regard, too. Don't just drop in. Call them. You
yes.
know, set something up. I mean, I know our farm does a big formal tour every year. This year, it's September 18th. And we're not always there at the farm. I mean, I run deliveries every day. I go to farmers markets. It is a working, functioning business. And don't assume that a farmer can just drop everything to give you a tour if you want to stop by. So, you know, respect that person's business, too. And more often than not, they will be happy to have you stop by at a agreed upon time.
Absolutely.
Turner Farm is a little different, I guess.
Yeah.
It is the exception to the rule, but we have an educational mission, so that's why you can come to the farm and walk around anytime except for Sunday. So you can come and see what the working farm is like, and if you pass by myself, I can, or any of the garden crew, we can talk to you about how we raise our vegetables. You can see how we raise our vegetables. And likewise with the meat, the animals are kind of all over the place depending on what day it is. So
let's talk with Jane in Dayton. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I'm a beginning gardener, but I live in a small apartment with no opportunity for gardening. And yet on my morning walks, I pass vacant lot after vacant lot that in my eyes is prime for urban gardening or community gardening. And I'm just wondering how one would go about contacting the city or the town, partnering maybe with local neighborhood organizations to turn that empty, you know, land that's not being used into, again, urban gardens or community gardens.
That is a wonderful
vegetable growing.
That's a wonderful question. And council representatives, any local or your community organizations or associations, a lot of times with these vacant lots, especially in older neighborhoods, there might be some soil contamination, and you have to think about that before any production is made. So, again, once things are approved, you have to make sure that you get your soil tested. A lot of the older neighborhoods used lead-based paint, and so you definitely need to make sure because that can be toxic, it is toxic in the soil. So it is definitely blooming, but it's not. And it also water. A lot of folks, you know, you see a vacant lot. Well, what are you going to put on there? Are you going to put wildflowers? Are you going to put trees? Are you going to put vegetables? But you need a water source. So you have to remember that you need water for that area, too, and safety, of course.
You also need soil.
Yeah. So soil.
Yeah.
When we started growing that chef program, we started growing at Liberty and Elm. You could put a shovel down maybe an inch because it used to be a building. So
yeah.
Just because it's vacant doesn't necessarily mean that it's suitable for growing anything. The Civic Garden Center is a really great resource in terms of being able to, like, they understand, they've gone through the process with all of their community gardens, you know, learning how to access that land and learning sort of the ins and outs of how to turn that vacant lot into something.
And that's
productive.
One of the program areas that I work with in Campbell County. So if this is of interest to you, you know, I am happy. I was co-author of a publication of Community Gardens and Development. So I am happy to share that with you and how to get that done. It has to be a celebration of that whole community and understanding. Doesn't necessarily mean everybody has to get their hands dirty, but there has to be an understanding that this is going in and what is it going to be used for and how you're going to manage it and who's going to manage it. So a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Good.
And we have a link to the Campbell.
Go ahead and check with your local extension service in your community there, and they may have knowledge of resources that's already, in other words, there's already programs out there that you can touch base with, and they can give you advice. And check with your local community leaders about these vacant lots and see what the opportunities might be for them. So I encourage you to go for this.
Let's talk to Janice in Finneytown. Hi, Janice.
Hi. Let's see. Talking about the bamboo again, you said that you were able to get rid of your bamboo? Because mine's just overtaking the whole yard. The plant, the neighbor did a one plant, I think, 30 years ago.
It's entrenched.
So we, you know, really what we did is this whole winter, we just, well, first of all, we cut it down. And that was a chore, let's just say. And and with some loppers, and then we started digging, and we broke shovels, and then we got a very heavy duty tiller. Once we dug as much of it out as possible, we also then, which is very important to know this, we sprayed right onto the wound of once after we cut of glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, which is a non-selective herbicide. So, you know, we did that multiple times because it had we had no other sustainable way to do that. And you know, and if we saw, we didn't just do the whole thing, we sprayed it right onto that wound because we had other desirable plants around. So we were very cautious about that, and we're still fighting it, but we're increasingly
you're winning
we are winning, and we'll see a little sprout and we'll just dig it out. So it's not like we're going in there and spraying glyphosate everywhere. As soon as we see another sprig, we just get it out, because it's not woody at that time.
It sounds, Sarah, like you just have to keep at it to get rid of it.
This is, you know, it took us over a year to get rid of it, and that's not the end. So, but we're increasing our diversity of plant material, so we're trying to outcompete. Every time we dig a hole to plant a echinacea in there, we're finding bamboo roots. Most of them are dead tissue. So congratulations on that. But, you know, it's going to be an ongoing, you know, ongoing. And if it's not your planting, you know, maybe you need to have a nice conversation with whomever planted it.
Oh, well, that's been 30 years ago. I mean, it's
30 years ago.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You can't treat it as an invasive species, and that's what it really is, an invasive type plant.
It really
is, there's things out there on the market that kill brushy type plants, and that's probably what another opportunity as well.
And I don't know about burning, but, you know, depending upon where you're located, that may be something you've caught.
Too close.
Okay.
Too close
then,
close
can't do that. Because that's what we considered as well, but
Janice, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We had an email from Peter. He has a redbud tree that looks healthy, but it's losing large chunks of bark. So he's wondering if anybody knows what might be causing that.
Well, it could be sun scald. We call those abiotic conditions, not related to any disease or insect. So maybe it could be mechanical injury from a weed eater, from a mower. Wood, it expands and contracts. So those cells, over time, if it doesn't heal properly, can get a very, it can get a hole in there, or it could get cracks. If we go on the biotic side, thinking of insects, there are bark borers that get in, and beetles that get in between the bark and the cambium layers. Lightning, for example, which is another environmental abiotic. So just that description. So my suggestion
is,
take it to the extension office. Send us pictures. Let's start there.
Don, Kate, Megan, and Sarah, thanks for being here this afternoon. We appreciate all the good advice. My guests this afternoon have been Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Crop Production Manager at Turner Farm Megan Gambrill, and from the Campbell County Extension Office, Horticulture Agent Sarah Stolls and Agriculture Agent Don Sorrell.